part 9 of 13 from set number 2005, introducing C.G. Jung's Red Book, a BC Recordings copyrighted presentation by Stefan Heller entitled Jung's Red Book, Scrutinies, Part 1.
And so with that, we'll launch into this evening's discussion. First of all, I think a word may need to be said about scrutinies itself, the work. Dr. Shamdasani, in his introduction to the published Red Book, describes the scrutinies portion of the Liber Novus as follows, if I can find it here. Yeah, there it is. In the winter of 1917, Jung wrote a fresh manuscript called Scrutinies, which began where he had left off. In this he transcribed his insights and fantasies from April 1913 until June 1916. These dates are a little confusing, and let's say they are not really that essential. The chronology is not really that essential. As in the first two books of the Red Book, or Liber Novus, the new book, as Jung called it, Jung interspersed the fantasies with interpretive commentaries. He included the Sermones, this is the seven sermons, in this material, and now added Philemon's commentaries on each sermon. In these, Philemon stressed the compensatory nature of his teaching. He deliberately stressed precisely those conceptions that the dead, and we'll talk about that later, those are the questioning entities for whose benefit, at least poetically, the sermons were written, that the dead lacked. Scrutinies effectively forms Liber Tertius, which for those of you, well, how shall we put it for you, people in the New World who don't know any Latin, but we have some here who do. My friend is way ahead of me in Latin, you know. But that means the third book, Liber Tertius, of the Red Book. The complete sequence of the texts would thus be Liber Primus, first book, the way of what is to come. Liber Secundus, the second book, the images of the Erring. Liber Tertius, third book, Scrutinies. During this period, Jung continued transcribing the draft into the calligraphic volume and adding paintings. The fantasies in the black books became more intermittent. He portrayed his realization of the significance of the self, which took place in the autumn of 1917 in Scrutinies. This contains Jung's vision of the reborn God, culminating in the portrayal of Abraxas. This is all going to come in the next couple of talks. He realized that much of what was given to him in the earlier part of the book, that is, in the first and the second book, which we have completed now, was actually given to him by Philemon. He realized that there was a prophetic wise old man in him to whom he was not identical. Now, these are very subtle and a little bit tricky expressions. It was in him, but he was not identical with Jung. This represented a critical disidentification. On January 17, 1918, Jung wrote to J.B. Lang, "The work on the unconscious has to happen first and foremost for us ourselves. Our patients profit from it indirectly. The danger consists in the prophet's delusion, which often is the result of dealing with the unconscious. It is the devil who says, 'Disdain all reason and science, mankind's highest powers.' That is never appropriate, even though we are forced to acknowledge the existence and the value of the irrational. Jung's critical task in working over his fantasies was to differentiate the voices and characters. For example, in the Black Books, those, as you may recall, are the initial notebooks in which Jung wrote down his visions and commentaries, and from there they were then transcribed, eventually to reach the calligraphic version in the Red Book itself. So working over his fantasies was to differentiate the voices of characters. For example, in the Black Books, it is Jung's eye who speaks the sermones to the dead. In Scrutinies, it is not Jung's eye, but Philemon who speaks them. In the Black Books, the main figure with whom Jung has dialogues is his soul. In some sections of the Red Book Liber Novus, this is changed to the serpent and the bird. In one conversation in January 1916, his soul explained to him that when the above and below are not united, she falls into three parts: a serpent, the human soul, and the bird, the heavenly soul, which visits the gods. Thus Jung's revision here can be seen to reflect his understanding of the tripartite nature of his soul. Now we need to keep in mind, and this will be essential for some of our material today too, that when the translations here, Dr. Shamdasani's translations say soul, he translates primarily the German word Seele, which in turn is the word for psyche. The early pioneers of depth psychology, including Freud and Jung and others, Adler and so forth, wrote in German. And they used German words for a great many of the terms that now in depth psychology are all Greek or Latin. Why this kind of complication has occurred is another story. But so really what we are dealing with here is when he says his psyche, the totality of his psyche in three parts. Now that of course is a traditional concept from antiquity, wherein for thousands of years it was generally believed that the human being consists of body, soul, and spirit, and under the body there is also to be understood a sort of bodily soul. So a bodily soul, the soul, and the spirit. This is the tripartite division, the tripartite nature of the soul. Now, with that, we can go on now with our considerations of Scrutinies. The text of Scrutinies begins with a monologue addressed by Jung's higher consciousness to what he repeatedly calls my I. So, you know, these dialogues between what he calls his soul and the I, in fact, reflect a way in which he dealt with his own psyche for a very long time, because in his autobiographical work, Memories, Dreams and Reflections, for instance, it is indicated that from very early in his life he was aware of these two selves, the I and something higher, that is the soul. In the Red Book, he becomes aware of some things even higher than that. So in a footnote attached to this discourse with which Scrutinies begins, Dr. Shamdasani writes, Jung later describes the self-criticism depicted in this opening section as the confrontation with the shadow. In 1934, Jung wrote, "Whoever looks into the mirror of the water will see first of all his own image. Whoever goes to himself risks a confrontation with himself. The mirror does not flatter. It faithfully shows whatever looks into it, namely the face we never show to the world, because we cover it with the persona, the mask of the actor, but the mirror lies behind the mask and shows the true face. This confrontation is the first test of courage on the inner way, a test sufficient to frighten off most people. For the meeting with ourselves belongs to the more unpleasant things that can be avoided as long as one can project everything negative into the environment. So if you get to see yourself, that's really the dangerous part. My illustrious relative Count Dracula has discovered that long ago, for which reason he never has any mirrors in his castle, neither do his compatriots of similar culinary proclivities, you know. So then, this is a great, this confrontation then, as he says, is a great test of courage. Great test of courage. But if we are able to see our shadow, says Dr. Shamdasani, quoting Jung, and can bear knowing about it, then a small part of the problem has already been solved. We have at least brought up the personal unconscious. This, incidentally, these statements are from Jung's essay on the archetypes of the collective unconscious in volume 9 of the collected works. So Jung argues now in the first part of Scrutinies, he argues with his lowest self or shadow, and he does this in his usual dramatic and forceful way. Probably by now it has not escaped your notice that a lot of these dialogues are, very dramatic and contain a lot of, really heavy arguing and name-calling as well. That really makes it properly dramatic. He calls the shadow all sorts of bad names and epithets, depicting this entity as, and I quote, disgusting, mendacious, inferior, debased, pursuing vile swindles and deceptions. Does it remind you of some people you know? It probably does. But you see, that's just it. While these proclivities exist in us just like this, of course we see them always in others. That doesn't mean that it's not present in others. It doesn't mean that the world is not full of nasty and deceptive and despicable people. Of course it is. But the unfortunate fact is that so are we. You see, so are we. And here he gives voice to that. Interestingly, the entity which at one point he calls my base, empty, nothing I, nothing-I, probably a gar nichts selbst in German, that this nothing I never answers him. We only have a monologue of Jung's berating this lower self of his. The most likely reason for this is that Jung is confronting this entity, and by thus confronting it, he brings it to consciousness. It is not necessary to have a lot of replies from it. Interestingly, the entity is there, but doesn't really react very much to Jung's berating. Jung notes that after his confrontation, he was more at ease and began to bear being alone with himself. So it's a little bit like when you have been, very annoyed with somebody for a long time, and then finally you really tell them off, And that's it. Afterwards you feel so good. Now the other party may not feel so good, but you feel better. And now that it has been thus expressed, he has a greater ease with the totality of his psyche. Still he flagellates himself over this, as he puts it, I had to lash myself just as often. Now, after his long encounter with this lower or lowest soul, Jung now once again has an encounter with his higher, his more spiritual soul. But now he speaks to what he generally refers to as his soul. Then I heard a voice one night. It came from afar and was the voice of my soul. She spoke, "How distant you are." So he replies, "Is that you, my soul? From which height and distance do you speak?" "Soul, I am above you. I am a world apart. I have become sun-like. I received the seeds of fire. Where are you? I can hardly find you in your mists." I am down on the murky earth, in the dark smoke that the fire left us, and my gaze does not reach you, but your voice sounds closer. It almost sounds as if Jung had been speaking from Los Angeles, California, with the dark smoke. You know, soul speaks, "I feel it. The heaviness of the earth penetrates me. Damp cold enshrouds me. Gloomy memories of former pain overcome me." Then his eye speaks again. "Do not lower yourself into the smoke and the darkness of the earth. I would like that which I am still working on to remain sun-like. Otherwise, I will lose the courage to live further down in the darkness of the earth. Let me just hear your voice. I will never want to see you in the flesh again. Say something. Take it from the depths from which fear perhaps flows to me." The soul says, "I cannot, since your creative source flows from there." You see my uncertainty, soul. The uncertain way is the good way. Upon it lie possibilities. Be unwavering and create. There's a little lesson there for us in other matters too, you know. The people who are kind of dangerous in this world are generally the people who are so absolutely certain concerning their opinions and judgments. That is always a bad sign. But where there is some ambiguity, there is the possibility of the discovery of new truths. When you lock yourself into a false certainty of your opinions, obviously nothing else comes in. And this is a very frequent difficulty with people. So maybe the little adage that we could adopt here is, don't be so sure. Don't be so sure. Now then, I heard the rushing of wings. I knew that the bird rose higher above the clouds in the fiery brilliance of the outspread Godhead, because the highest aspect of his soul in the latter part of Liber Secundus of the second book began to appear as a bird. The lower part of his soul, the sort of the terrestrial part, appeared as the serpent. So a certain duality appears there also. I turned to my brother, the eye. He stood sadly and looked at the ground and sighed, and would rather have been dead, since the burden of enormous suffering burdened him. But a voice broke from me and said, "It is hard. The sacrificed fall left and right, and you will be crucified for the sake of life." And I said to my eye, "My brother, how do you like this speech?" As if he didn't know how he liked it. But he sighed deeply and moaned, "It is bitter, and I suffer much." To which I answered, "I know, but it is not to be altered." But I did not know what that was, since I still did not know what the future held. This happened, he interjects, this is Jung's own note, this happened on the 21st May of the year 1914. In the excess of suffering, I looked up to the clouds and called out to my soul and asked her, And I heard her voice happy and bright, and she answered, "Much happiness has happened to me. I rise higher, my wings grow." There is, of course, a little difference there between the way the lower self and the soul feel. There is a certain amount of argument directed by Jung in the subsequent portion at the soul. There seems to be a sort of tripartite division, the lowest self or shadow below, the higher soul above, and Jung's own ordinary consciousness in the middle. Once again, I would like to call attention to the fact that this is not some kind of split personality phenomenon on the part of Jung, but that actually in various branches of the esoteric tradition, you have a whole bunch of part selves appearing, probably the most complex being the sevenfold division of the human being, which would include the physical, which originated with the ancient Egyptians. And in Hindu esoteric systems and some Buddhist esoteric systems, we have five. So, you know, the notion that there are, there's a sort of a layer cake arrangement of different soul components, higher and lower, is not a view that originates in some personal pathology, but really it is something that has been recognized for a long time by many different people and many different traditions. At the end of his dialogue with the soul, Jung mentions to his soul that he is subject to doubts. His soul says to him that he doubts, not as he thinks because of his love for men, but because of his weakness. Then his soul tells him as follows, and I quote, "Stay on your way and do not run away from yourself. There is a divine and human intention. They cross each other in stupid and God-forsaken people to whom you also belong from time to time." There's not too much mincing of words on either side goes on here. I sort of wonder, I have never lived in Switzerland, although I lived pretty close to it, whether there may be sort of Swiss folk customs that you argue a lot and in the course of the argument you berate each other. I'm sure that that can be quite exciting and pleasant at times. But you sure see a lot of it here. So they cross each other, the divine and the human intention. There is the lesser will and the higher will. Once again, this is not unique. It is unique in this context. But we have, for instance, some psychologists of more recent vintage, existential psychologists like Rollo May or so, who spoke of will and intentionality. Will being, in that case, the lesser, intentionality being the higher. And that, of course, is a very important issue in Jungian psychology itself, because one of the most important objectives of Jungian therapy, analysis, whatever you may call it, has always been the reconciling and perhaps facilitating ultimately the unification of the part selves, which have been called complexes, even autonomous complexes, because they all act on their own. That, incidentally, is a term that originated with Jung. It didn't originate with any other psychologist. And why he called them complexes? Well, perhaps because they are complex. That may not be a great revelation, but it may be useful nevertheless. Jung then, in his usual way, muses on the words of his soul in regard to belief. Some of his statements are, "Belief may be something strong, but it is empty, and too little of the whole man can be involved. If our life with God is grounded only on belief, Should we simply believe first and foremost question? That seems too cheap to me. Men who have understanding should not just believe, but should wrestle for knowledge to the best of their ability. Belief is not everything, but neither is knowledge. Belief does not give us the security and the wealth of knowing. Desiring knowledge sometimes takes away too much belief. Both must strike a balance. One can agree, I think, but the question arises from our point of view whether the term knowledge here also would include higher knowledge spiritually and intuitively arrived at as gnosis, or perhaps only mundane knowledge. More conversation ensues, in which the soul gives Jung directions how to proceed. He says he must accept solitude in his acquisition of insight. He is told to take his leave from science in this case. There is too much childishness in science, says his soul, in those very words, and therefore it is not useful for his purposes. He is told that his way goes toward the depths. Science is superficial, mere language, mere tools. But he must set to work. He then reports, "Then one night I heard the voice of an old man." He spoke slowly, heavily, and his sentences appeared to be disconnected and terribly abstruse. The center, the heart of this communication seemed to be the words, "It is not yet evening of days. The worst comes last." That's sort of a happy, optimistic thought. Then there follow several metaphors, all indicating that one comes late or even last, and that is often the most important. These words of the old man came to him on May 25, 1914. Then apparently the voices from the depths, as he calls them, remained silent for a little over a year. Synchronicities began occurring. Jung was out on the water alone, no doubt on the Lake of Zurich. He saw a bird, possibly a kingfisher, although one report says osprey. He saw this bird plunge down and seize a fish, with which he flew upwards into the sky. Jung heard the voice of his soul, and the soul spoke, "That is a sign that what is below is borne upward." Then a new and powerful action began. Soon after this, on an autumn night, I heard the voice of an old man, and this time I knew that it was Philemon. As always, you know, when he uses the name Philemon, it is spelled in capital Greek letters. It's something like a divine name. He said, that is, Philemon said, "I want to turn you around. I want to master you. I want to emboss you like a coin. I want to do business with you. One should buy and sell you." That's a pretty weird term. "You should pass from hand to hand. Self-willing is not for you. You are the will of the whole. Gold is no master out of its own will, and yet it rules the whole, despised and greedily demanded, an inexorable ruler. It lies and waits. He who sees it longs for it. It does not follow one around, but lies silently," yeah, in the bank vault, "silently with a brightly gleaming countenance, self-sufficient, a king that needs no proof of its power. Everyone seeks after it, few find it, but even the smallest piece is highly esteemed. It neither gives nor squanders itself. Everyone takes it where he finds it, and anxiously ensures that he doesn't lose the smallest part of it. Everyone denies that he depends on it, and yet he secretly stretches out his hand longingly toward it. Must gold prove its necessity? It is proven through the longing of men. Ask it, who takes me? He who takes it has it. Gold does not stir. It sleeps and shines. Its brilliance confuses the senses. Without a word, it promises everything that men deem desirable. It ruins those to be ruined and helps those on the rise to ascend. A blazing hoard is piled up. It awaits the taker. What tribulations do men not take upon themselves for the sake of gold? It waits and does not shorten their tribulations. The greater the tribulations, the greater the trouble, the more esteemed it is. It grows from underground, from the molten lava. It slowly exudes hidden in veins and rocks. Man exerts all cunning to dig it out and raise it. Jung is dismayed by this long metaphor about this precious but material substance. And he feels that he is being likened to a precious commodity for sale, namely gold. This may indeed have been, among other things, a prefiguration of his teachings about the alchemical significance of gold. Philemon continues to indicate that whenever one teaches, one can be misunderstood or badly understood. He indicates that Jung's daimon, meaning a tutelary spirit from ancient Greek nomenclature, that Jung's daimon is Hermes, and thus he needs to be a messenger and someone whose wisdom becomes a public kind of knowledge. You need to recall also that the Roman manifestation or translation of Hermes is Mercury. And Mercury, in turn, probably more than Hermes in mythology, is the patron of commerce, the patron of the... Because commerce is just another way of distributing things, distributing, as Hermes is the messenger of ideas and inspiration from the gods, Mercury sees to it that goods are exchanged, that things go back and forth. And so if his tutelary deity is Hermes, it has to do with the fact that Jung's teachings and his psychological teachings are here ultimately to go to people. Like it is a precious teachings, it is a precious new approach to life which ultimately needs to come to people on the wings of Hermes. So his tutelary spirit is Hermes, and thus he needs to be the messenger, and someone whose wisdom becomes therefore ultimately a public kind of knowledge. Jung muses on Philemon's words. At the end of the musings, there is a momentous statement. Through uniting with the self, we reach the God. Now, this is tremendously important, because here in one sentence is, you might say, distilled a tremendous amount of the material, of the prophetic material, of the visions, of the disclosures of the entire Red Book. This is a most important maxim. Interestingly enough, the God is called Der Gott, the God. He has the prefix there, which has a special meaning in German, and it sort of takes his God image, you might say here, out of the ordinarily accustomed Judeo-Christian, maybe even Islamic, Judeo-Christian Islamic monotheistic God image. You know, this is not Jehovah with a great big beard, or Allah who forbids everything except killing people, at least nowadays, you know. But it is Der Gott. You see it appearing in the writings of some German poets. For instance, Hölderlin, who was a great mystical poet, you know. As I recall, I hope I recall it correctly. Nah ist und schwer zu fassen der Gott, wo aber Gefahr ist, dann hat das Rettende auch. No, you understood that perfectly well. Mm-hmm. I don't need to translate. There is, he says, near but difficult to grasp is the God, but where there is danger, there the saving power approaches. Also one of my favorite quotes from Hölderlin. So this is the their God. So here follows what might be arguably a very high account of Jung's own gnosis. Okay. In the following night, I heard the voice of Philemon again, and he said, "Draw nearer, enter into the grave of the God. The place of your work should be in the vault. The God should not live in you, but you should live in the God." See, these reciprocities are present. On the one hand, there are some statements, yes, the God is in you. On the other hand, you should be in the God. "These words disturbed me," says Jung, "since I had sought before precisely to free myself from this. But Philemon advised me to enter even deeper into the God. Since the God has ascended to the upper realms," here he's speaking, you know, some of the earlier visionary imagery, "since the God has ascended to the upper realms, Philemon also has become different. He first appeared to me as a magician who lived in a distant land, but then I felt his nearness, and since the God has ascended, I knew that Philemon had intoxicated me and given me a language that was foreign to me and of a different sensitivity," a new kind of consciousness. "All of this faded when the God arose, and only Philemon kept that language. But I felt that he went on other ways than I did. Probably the most part of what I have written," here is what Shamdasani mentioned earlier in the introduction where he described scrutinies, "but probably the most part of what I have written in the earlier part of this book was all given to me by Philemon. Consequently, I was as if intoxicated, but now I noticed that Philemon assumed a form distinct from me." This is not without, I think, some very profound aspects. Jung acknowledges his truly close relationship to Philemon. I mean, this is something that doesn't come all at once. It is something that develops over the two books and now fully begins to manifest in the third book. Perhaps the most portentous statement is where he says, "Probably the most part of what I have written in the earlier part of this book was given to me by Philemon." There is also reference to whether Philemon is internal or external to Jung's psyche. "Philemon, you assumed a form distinct from me." Now, this brings up a major mystery. To what extent are what I think unfortunately have been called, due to, I think, a kind of inadequate translations from the German, fantasy figures, such as Philemon, are they internal to the psyche, and to what extent are they of an objective or a quasi-objective nature? Statements such as the aforementioned hint at a possibility of such objectivity. Perhaps there are figures that could be called archetypal beings. I am certainly inclined to that possibility. And when we look into the various manifestations of the esoteric tradition, going back long ways all the way to the Greeks and the Egyptians, we find these strange kind of ambiguous figures. On the one hand, we can see, they wear the image, the garb of what Jung came to call archetypes. On the other hand, they seem to have a tremendous amount of autonomy, tremendous amount of objectivity. Which is it? And perhaps this is one of those issues where we have to continue to bear the burden of the mystery, the burden of ambiguity. Once again, once you decide, it's all outside. This is a master who probably lives in the Himalayas and eats curry day and night, and then, you know, this is some kind of a guru, and that's it. You have limited the mystery to something. It may not be entirely untrue what you are saying, but the problem is that when you consider that to be the only true explanation of the phenomenon, then you exclude others. And so this is where we have to bear the tension of the ambiguity. And in that ambiguity is the revelation of the mystery. I know this doesn't make a great deal of sense on a rational level, but then we are not really dealing with anything here very much on that level anyhow. Similarly, on the other hand, which I think is what a lot of psychologists, including Jungian psychologists, have been guilty of, it's all inside. It's all inside. That's all it is. It's an archetype, it's a this, that's a that. When I hear that sort of thing, and I always cringe and I say, do you know what an archetype is? You know? Naming it is not understanding it. These are some of our problems. This is all psychologism and rationalism, which is different from psychology and reason. And so I think we have to leave the mystery open. And we can see it is inside and it is outside. It is above and it is below. It is here and it is there and it is nowhere. Certainly to a rational mind, these seem like silly statements. But they are not. And if you look into the writings of the great mystics and Gnostics, certainly the Gnostic scriptures, we find a lot of that. And perhaps it is that kind of attitude that we need to adopt toward these matters, especially the figure of Philemon. Now a different kind of entity appears. A figure described as a dead one, or a shade. Shady character. One of several such, I mean there are several of them floating around, but this one comes to Jung and starts talking with him. The shade is female and is apparently of Egyptian origin, for she buzzes with the sound of the scarab beetle, sacred to the sun, the wings of the beetle. Before she became a shade, she encountered Jung in the Egyptian desert, and maybe some of us still have a recollection of an early episode, which is the episode where he meets the anchorite in the Egyptian desert. And that is where apparently she says she met him before. But she was alive then, she is dead now. The female shade desires communion with Jung and recites a long prayer which she wishes Jung to learn to recite. This prayer is designed to give living power to the shades and demand sacrifices for their sake from the living. It's not at all uncommon in magic, in folk magic, whether it's in Egypt or anywhere else, that when you want to have a shade, a spook, a spirit appear in a more material form, that you make a sacrifice to it. Often, whatever it may be, a chicken, or if there is no chicken around, then something else. The sacrifice is usually, you know, present. But Jung is put off by what to me would appear to be, this doesn't appear in the book, of course, but sort of vampire-like nature of this shade. And he notices that this doesn't sit right with him. There is something wrong here. He essentially refuses then the request of the dead shade. He says, no, I am not going to bring you back to life. As he thus refuses and rebukes the dead, he notices that Philemon is with him. As I proclaimed these words, I noticed Philemon stood behind me and had given them to me. Philemon gave him the words of refusal. Given them to me. He came alongside me invisibly, and I felt the presence of the good and the beautiful. So now, you know, he recognizes that Philemon is a representative of the good and the beautiful, as well as probably of the true. We are back with the ancient Greeks. And it's, of course, interesting to note how Jung's attitude toward Philemon has changed, and has changed for the better. Philemon no longer appears to him as a magician, as a zauberer, as we mentioned in another talk, conjurer, because that's the word used, with trickster-like qualities. He is his teacher and inspirer. Jung's attitude to most of the figures who appear to him is quite critical, and his conversations with them are often argumentative. And as I mentioned before, he often calls them bad names and is similarly treated by them. Why this is, I don't know, I couldn't presume to know. But I have at least one idea, and that means that Jung does not accept the denizens of these other worlds uncritically. But he argues with them. He wants them to prove their points. He wants them to establish their identities, and give him their names and so forth. So it's a very, very different attitude from the kind of spaniel-eyed, drooling joy that we find in spiritualist and New Age circles whenever some spook seemingly appears. Oh, how wonderful. Ah, yeah. Here they are, you know, how wonderful. Well, it's not always wonderful. Sometimes you're way a lot better off without those things. Of course, it's unusual. There is a certain excitement in an unusual situation. But you should act with them as the Romans would say, sine ira et studio. Without anger or without anxious involvement, you know. And that's really what he does, and I think his argumentative way of dealing with these various entities is a manifestation of that. Here he apparently has been well advised to keep the dead shade at arm's length. Here are some of Philemon's statements to Jung after the initial event. Why don't the dead stay quiet? Because they have not crossed over to the other side, at least these dead. Why do they want sacrifice? So they can live. But why do they still want to live with men? Because they want to rule. They have not come to an end with their craving for power, since they died still lusting for power. A child, an old man, an evil woman, a spirit of the dead, and the devil are beings who need to be humored. Just humor them and get rid of them. And this is, of course, once again, it is really a manifestation of the attitudes towards such beings that have been present in the esoteric tradition. I am reminded of various pretty vociferous statements of the late and great Madame Blavatsky, who always said that these spooks, as she called them, who appear in spiritualist seances and so forth, are not worth bothering with. They are stupid, and they are not moving on as they ought to anything greater, and they often are manipulative, and they want something from you. They want power over you. Because they were manipulative, nasty people when they were on earth, and they have not shed these undesirable qualities with their body. He then goes on to speak of our own soul, whereby is meant, of course, the psyche of a quality above the basic human personality, higher soul. Philemon states that one's soul, psyche, needs to be kept close at hand and not allowed to roam about much among people. The wisdom of the psyche, he says, is the primordial cleverness of serpents. It's very much involved in serpent lore around here. I don't know. There must have been a lot of snakes in the mountains of Switzerland that they became such an important symbol to Jung. I sympathize with that. Because in the Alps there are some venomous serpents, vipers particularly. But for instance, where I grew up as a child in Hungary in the plain country, there were no venomous snakes at all. I used to play with the snakes as a child. I used to pick up little ones and bring them in the house and show them to my mother, somewhat to her displeasure. She wasn't all that fond of them as I was, but I thought they were just really, really great creatures. As indeed they are, but he calls them its cleverness of serpents. What he is alluding to, I think, is that the psyche, when not kept within bounds, becomes a diffuse and unreasonable tyrant. And what he says is you should not allow this higher soul to roam about with other people too much. I think what is meant here, among other things, perhaps, is you should not get too involved in projections of your soul. Keep it close to you. And that, I think, it's a very difficult and yet very important task. Because when your higher spiritually desirable nature and qualities are all projected onto other people, no doubt you will be in love with these people or you will think very highly of them. But at the same time, you will never really know those people the way they really are. And meanwhile, you are just taking away from yourself psychic material that you should be relating to and dealing with internally. Philemon's words on this issue, I think we might profit by, and we shall take a look at them. Here we are. May man rule in the human world. May his laws be valid. But treat the souls, daimons, and gods in their way, offering what they require. But burden no man, demand and expect nothing from him, with what your devil souls and god souls lead you to believe. But endure and remain silent and do piously what befits your kind. You should act not on the other, but on yourself, unless the other asks for your help or opinion. Do you understand what the other does? Never. How should you? Does the other understand what you do? Whence do you take the right to think about the other and act on him? You have neglected yourself. Your garden is full of weeds, and you want to teach your neighbor about order and provide evidence for his shortcomings. So, you know, don't be a busybody intruding into other people's psyche. Maybe not even if you have a license from the state of California to be a therapist, you know, be constrained. And certainly Jung always felt that the respect for the integrity, for the sovereignty of the other person's psyche is very, very great. And certainly there are many people within the psychological field who really don't abide by that. Those are important recognitions on many different levels. One evident example of what Philemon here tells Jung is also, I think, the evil work of political ideology in the 20th century, which of course bleeds over quite literally into the 21st century. Philemon says that your psyche should be kept for your purposes. When she is projected onto others, including society, she creates evil, havoc. our psyche is for ourselves, but projected onto other people, she becomes tyrannical and out of bounds. We certainly have seen intellectual creations, political and economic theories and ideologies foisted upon collectivities of people and become thus responsible for frightful evils. We might coin an expression, keep your psyche at home. And perhaps when you go out, keep her on a leash. That would be another one. However, I think these canine metaphors have to be controlled. It would be in accord with Philemon's statements here. Keep your psyche at home. Prior to these statements, he has warned Jung about the shades of the dead and other disembodied and immaterial beings, how they try to influence the living, demanding sacrifices from them, and so forth. After listening, let me interrupt myself with my own permission, that you also, in this regard, you also need to keep in mind that, you know, these observations were made in the first, or maybe the beginning of the second decade, in the first decade of the 20th century, at which time spiritualism, or spiritism as it is called in France and Latin countries, you know, was still quite a big popular thing. And so Jung, I think, Philemon warns Jung about these sorts of things. Don't concern yourself with these lower entities that hang around and manifest in seances and channelers and things of that sort. So after listening to Philemon's latest and lengthy sermon, Jung now addresses himself to his soul. Once again, he asks her in so many words whether she agrees with Philemon about having to be kept within bounds, namely her, and confined so as not to become projected onto people and with them into ideologies and opinions relating to people. At first, his soul actually thanks Jung for keeping her confined. And Jung is quite thankful for her gratitude. So there is a kind of mutual exchange of thanks here. Yet soon he is seized by fury and berates his soul once more. That's just the way he is. You know? Incidentally, the soul is always referred to as feminine. So it's a little bit of a battle of the sexes on a psychic and psychological level here. Then Philemon comes forward and speaks in Jung's name. His speech extols the soul and links it with a sort of world soul, using the symbolism here of the Virgin Mary. His words are a magnificent Marianic hymn, although with intrapsychic overtones. This I found really very interesting and very inspiring, especially if I find it now in the book. Yeah, here we are. While I spoke to my soul in this way, Philemon stood silently a little distance off. But now he stepped forward, laid his hand on my shoulder, and spoke in my name. Spoke in my name. You are blessed, virgin soul, praised be your name. You are the chosen one among women. You are the God-bearer. Praise be to you. Honor and fame be yours in eternity. You live in the golden temple. The peoples come from afar and praise you. We, your vassals, wait on your words. We drink red wine, dispensing a sacrificial drink in recollection of the meal of blood that you celebrated with us. We prepare a black chicken for a sacrificial meal in remembrance of the man who fed you. Now, this is sort of reminds one a little bit of Santeria and voodoo or so forth, but black chicken is all right. Especially by the time it's roasted, it's no longer black. You know, you got to keep that in mind. We invite our friends to the sacrificial meal, carrying wreaths of ivy and roses in remembrance of the farewell you took from your saddened vassals and maids. Let this day be a festival celebrating joy and life, the day upon which you, Blessed One, commence the return journey from the land of men where you have learned how to be a soul. You follow the sun who ascended and passed over. You carry us up as your soul and set yourself before the Son of God, maintaining your immortal right as an ensouled being. We are joyful. Good things will follow you. We lend you strength. We are in the land of men, and we are alive. After Philemon had ended, my soul looked saddened and pleased, and hesitated, and yet hurried to prepare herself to leave us and to ascend again, happy at the regained freedom. So it's really quite a remarkable statement where sort of, you might say, the feminine soul as manifest in Christendom as the Virgin Mary and others is sort of conflated here with the presence of the soul, also with a feminine quality within the individual. And so Philemon is, instead of telling Jung, now you shouldn't berate your soul like that, rather than he praises the soul and compensates for Jung's initially negative attitude. Jung's soul then is about to once again rise on high to the heavenly kingdom, but Jung suspects that she is trying to take something important with her, thus depriving his humanity of something very precious. He is always suspicious of her. The soul confesses that she is desirous of, as she calls it, warm human love, which she calls incomparable. But Jung apparently persuades her not to depart, but to remain here and to work with him for humankind. One of his statements addressed to the soul is the following, "And I have an obligation to lay on you. Learn to honor humankind. For I saw the land that is promised to man, the land where milk and honey flows." That, of course, is a reference to the promised land from the Bible, from Exodus. He then continues, "I saw the land of promised love. I saw the splendor of the sun on the land. I saw the green forests, the golden vineyards, and the villages of man. I saw the towering mountains with hanging fields of eternal snow. I saw the fruitfulness and fortune of the earth. None but I saw the fortune of man. You, my soul, force mortal men to labor and suffer for your salvation. I demand that you do this for the earthly fortune of humankind also. Pay heed. You will be working for me, and I will remain silent." Now, what are we dealing with here? Once again, I don't presume to read Jung's mind. But I think that what we are, at least one aspect of what we are speaking of here is the tendency of the soul to, you know, rise to ecstatic mystical heights, and then, as it were, stay there as long as it can. And so Jung says, yes, you know, Jung, but you and I have a work to do here. So we can't go into the higher realms a great deal and get stuck there. We have to bring from our own understanding, from our own vision, from our own inspiration, from the teachings of Philemon and so forth, we have to bring the material and use it here for the enlightenment and the liberation of humans, so that he is advocating an attitude of service to humanity in lieu of a departure of consciousness and the withdrawal of consciousness into very pleasant and very high and ecstatic states, but without bringing any of it forth to be able to impart it to others. In Buddhism, I think that this would have to do with the bodhisattva attitude, that one has to help to to bring enlightenment to others and not merely wish to be enlightened oneself. Then the soul gives an indication of what this work will be or will be like. She tells Jung to build a furnace into which various ingredients, and she enumerates the old, the broken, the worn out, the unused and the ruined, will be thrown in order to change and to be reconstituted into something new. The description becomes even more explicit further on. It speaks here, it is the custom of the ancients, the tradition of the ancestors, observed since days of old. It is to be adopted for new use. It is practice and incubation in a smelter, a taking back into the interior, the hot accumulation where rust and brokenness are taken away through the heat of the fire. It is a holy ceremony. Help me so that my work may succeed. Now this is the soul that tells this now to Jung at this point, because he has persuaded her to stay here and work with him. So these are the works spoken by the soul. The activity that the soul suggests, and maybe that has occurred to you already as I was reading the words, that the activity that the soul suggests resembles nothing as much as alchemy. It is generally assumed that Jung's interest in alchemy was not kindled until the 1920s, in part as the result of his friendship and the collaboration with Richard Wilhelm. Yet this is one of several references to what is probably alchemy in the Red Book. In the Red Book itself, which is itself is written only in 1916. So I feel that there are indications of the forthcoming involvement of Jung with alchemy already at this early time. Of course, we need to mention, as is fairly evident by now, that what Jung really undertook when he started his work with alchemy was sort of the translation, the transmogrification of his gnosis expressed in the Red Book into a symbol system that he and others felt could be communicated to humankind at that time. And certainly in retrospect, that seems like it has been a wise move. Now, some of you may think that even the alchemical symbolism as present in psychology and alchemy and the other alchemically related books of Jung, that even that is really abstruse and weird. Well, of course it is. But it is different from the Red Book. If he had really published the Red Book as his soul was trying to tell him at that time, I think it would have fallen flat. Maybe not entirely, you know, there would have been probably a small coterie of people who were ready for it, but his expressing the psychological, the psycho-spiritual truths in alchemical terms was of great import and of great usefulness and found fairly ready acceptance. But we see the flashes, the lightning flashes of forthcoming alchemical work already in this text also, as we have just indicated. Now then Jung reports that he did as his soul advised, and then he has a vision of some ominousness. He says, and I quote, "I fear something terrible and dreadful." And then he asks his soul what all this means. Then his soul gives him a prophecy that is really rather frightening in nature. And it's longer than this, but this seems to be, I think, more or less his essence. Now just listen to this. "But she looked straight into the distance," that is the soul, "and said, I see the surface of the earth, and smoke sweeps over it. A sea of fire rolls close in from the north. It is setting the towns and villages on fire, plunging over the mountains, breaking through the valleys, burning the forests. People are going mad. You go before the fire in a burning robe with singed hair. That is you, Jung. A crazy look in your eyes, a parched tongue, a hoarse and foul-sounding voice. You forge ahead. You announce what approaches. You scale the mountains. You go into every valley and stammer words of fright and proclaim the fire's agony. You bear the mark of the fire, and men are horrified at you. They do not see the fire, they do not believe your words, but they see your mark and unknowingly suspect you to be the messenger of the burning agony. What fire, they ask, what fire? You stutter, you stammer, what do you know about a fire? I looked at the embers, I saw the blazing flames. May God save us. Pretty terrifying. It somewhat reminds one of the dire prophecies that you find in the certain Hermetic books, in the Corpus Hermeticum, where it says, oh, Egypt, Egypt, you know, your doom is to you. Now, here, okay. The interpretation of these words is certainly difficult and doubtful. Written in 1916, it may pertain to the latter and very destructive period of World War I. At the same time, there exists a possibility that it pertains to another, even more destructive catastrophe, apparently foretold or really experienced in several visions by Jung shortly before his death. A catastrophe involving a very widespread fiery destruction. It was said to occur about 50 years after Jung's vision, which means 1961 plus 50, 2011. I just threw it out as a little elementary mathematics. In any event, it appears very likely that this prediction may pertain to an actual physical catastrophe, past or future. By the same token, a symbolic meaning of the passage may be involved, either in lieu of or in addition to the physical. This, incidentally, if you want to know more about that particular material, this was told in the movie A Matter of Heart by, I believe it, I have it somewhere, probably by Marie-Louise von Franz, who was there when Jung had, I think, about 3 of these visions not long before his death. Now, the next portion of scrutinies, which we will begin on the next occasion, consists of the 7 sermons to the dead, which here possess a context which the exegesis written before the publication of the Red Book did not possess. Among these, very great importance needs to be attributed to Philemon's commentaries, which are contained in scrutinies and which were not available prior to the publication of the Red Book in 2009. And as many of you know, my effort in that regard, the Gnostic Jung and the 7 Sermons to the Dead, was really pretty much the only accessible non-academic work on that subject for a lot of years, so I have a close connection with it. But now we will take a look at it within this context, which I think will be most illuminating indeed. It may be of interest at this juncture, I think we can still do that, to have another glimpse of how C.G. Jung regarded his religious prophetic mission, which, after all, is documented in the Red Book. In his introduction to the Red Book, Dr. Shamdasani reproduces a dialogue between Jung and his spiritual soul as it occurred quite a bit later on January 5th, 1922, and is contained in Black Book number 7. I don't know whether the Black Book number 7 will be exhibited in the exhibit or not. Some of the black books are there. Here is the dialogue at a later time, but, you know, same kind of material as we have in the earlier material. I feel that I must speak to you, to the soul. Why do you not let me sleep as I am tired? I feel that the disturbance comes from you. What induces you to keep me awake? Bit of insomnia problems there. The soul says, now is no time to sleep, but you should be awake and prepare important matters in nocturnal work. The great work begins. I, what great work? Soul, the work that should now be undertaken. It is a great and difficult work. There is no time to sleep if you find no time during the day to remain in the work. But I had no idea that something of this kind was taking place. Soul, but you could have told by the fact that I have been disturbing your sleep for a long time. You have been too unconscious for a long time. Now you must go to a higher level of consciousness. I am ready. What is it? Speak. The soul says, you should listen. To no longer be a Christian is easy. But what next? For more is yet to come. Everything is waiting for you. And you? You remain silent and have nothing to say. But you should speak. Why have you received the revelation? You should not hide it. You concern yourself with the form. Is the form important when it is a matter of revelation? And Jung says to the soul, but you are not thinking that I should publish what I have written. That would be a misfortune. And who would understand it? Well, you know, that's a question. Especially since I wasn't around yet at that time. Now, of course, that has all changed very, very largely owing to my presence. You know. All right. And that is said in jest, because when that goes out over the airways, going to see how arrogant, how inflated he is. Well, I may be, but not on this issue right now. Okay. So the soul says, no, listen, you should not break up a marriage, namely the marriage with me. No person should supplant me. I want to rule alone. So keep listening to me. Jung says, so you want to rule? From whence do you take the right for such presumption? So the argument starts again. It's just like an old married couple. They always end up arguing at some point. So the soul says, this right comes to me because I serve you and your calling. I could just as well say you came first, but above all your calling comes first. But what is my calling, says Jung? The soul says, the new religion and its proclamation. It's right there. And Jung says, oh God, how should I do this? Soul says, do not be of such little faith. No one knows it as you do. There is no one who could say it as well as you could. Then Jung says, but who knows if you are not lying? The soul says, ask yourself if I am lying. I speak the truth. Very strange little dialogue indeed. Now, just sort of to place this into a proper context, I have found a couple of little items that are in other books relating to Jung that may be of interest. An item of some considerable interest appears in a book, little book called C.G. Jung, Emma Jung, and Tony Wolf, A Collection of Remembrances. It was published in 1982 in San Francisco. in a chapter entitled Jung as Seen by an Editor, a Student and a Disciple by Margaret Gildea, we read the following, and I quote, "People have asked me repeatedly about Jung's religious beliefs. Like most humans, I think his beliefs changed over the course of his long life. The last scholar I talked with who had seen him after his 80th birthday was Karl Karényi, the anthropologist, my fellow Hungarian. He said that like all old professors, Jung and he talked about their colleagues, and as to religion, Karényi said that he believed Jung thought of himself as a, and in quotation, as a kind of pope of the Gnostics." All right? We'll let that ride. Jung also said to Max Zeller, who was later a noted analyst in Los Angeles, he said to Max Zeller that a new religion, the new religion, would take 600 years to build. Of course, the 600 years appears in the Red Book earlier on. You'll find it in one of our lectures. So, with that, I think we can prepare ourselves for the consideration of Jung's seven sermons to the dead, as it appears in somewhat amended form in the scrutinies of the Red Book, which is also called Liber Novus. Now, let me just conclude by saying that it is quite evident that the Red Book, and for that matter, inasmuch as by his own statement, by his own admission, practically all of his later psychological work derives from the Red Book, is a sort of a spin-off from the Red Book, is designed not primarily to bring certain therapeutic techniques that will make people feel good and that might be more readily available than Prozac, depending on the situation, but rather that they are really to usher in a new spiritual dispensation, which maybe with the stretching of the term might be called a new religion. He uses the term religion. After all, what is religion? Religion is the religio, the reconnecting ourselves with some greater reality. And when he says that it is easy to throw out Christianity, it's easy to say I'm no longer the Christian, but what is going to come? This is, he says to Jung, this is where you have to play a role. And it may just be, or again, alternatively not. We always have to consider that too. After all, we've been told by Jung that it shouldn't all be one way. But it may be that the publication now in full of the three books of the Red Book is a giant step in that direction. And that now perhaps the discovery, the disclosure of various elements of a new spiritual dispensation will become available. However, don't be in too big a hurry and don't expect anything tomorrow, because the statement of 600 years still stands. But a journey of 600 years also begins with, well, a few days and months and years. And we may be, therefore, in the early part of that development. And if that is indeed the case, I welcome it with great joy. And I hope that our little exegetical efforts here may ever so slightly contribute to that development. And if that is the case, then our presence here tonight and other nights has not been in vain and will not be in vain. And in that hope and in that expectation, I conclude my remarks this evening. Thank you.
Catalog number 200509. For more information about available lecture titles and for many other resources, Visit gnosis.org. That's gnosis.org.